is that Julia Caulfield.
I'm just going to give a brief little intro and then pass it to our esteemed interviewer and panel of one. this evening, we're trying something new tonight. We're doing a live off the record from Telluride Arts HQ Gallery. This is a project that was kind of pitched to us in the fall when we were talking with members of the community about how we can make our news programming more accessible, more dynamic, how we can bring more folks into the fold. And someone suggested doing live off the record programming. And so that's what we're doing here today. We're broadcasting live from the Telluride Arts HQ Gallery. We have to give a huge, huge shout out to Telluride Arts and Austin for making this something that we can do and making this possible. So huge thank you to them. Also to Between the Covers Bookstore, who are supporting as well. If you think this is a great idea, whether you're here or not, let us know. We want to keep doing things like this, bringing our news programming into the community in different ways. And so let us know if this is something that you are interested in. And I'm going to let this one more person come in the door. And then we're going to get going. And I'm going to pass it off to Gavin.
Thank you so much, Julia. Thank you to Telluride Arts for hosting us in this beautiful space. You know, OTR, off the record, traditionally is about public affairs and engaging with folks. You know, we always have a vibrant live call-in element. So if you have a question this evening, do not call the station. We are not there. We are here. You have to come down here. And ask it. We have a little microphone for you. So if you have a question, come find the mic and see our lovely faces and see Telluride Arts. We are so excited to be joined this evening by Leslie Chang, joining us from Ridgeway. Leslie is a writer, a journalist. She was the Wall Street Journal's China correspondent for many years in the early aughts, yeah. She's written for The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, National Geographic, etc. She's done like TED Talks, so it's lovely to have you. In 2008, Leslie released her first book, Factory Girls, which follows the lives of two young women navigating that country's globalizing economy. The book was selected as a New York Times notable pick. And now, this March, Leslie, you've released your second book. So that's what we're discussing this evening. Thank you so much for being here. Give a hello to the listeners on the airwaves. And please fill in the blanks in your intro if I missed anything.
No, that was perfect. Hello. It's really nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. To the business of the new book. So it's called Egyptian Maid. Came out earlier this month. How's it been to get this out into the world?
It was a very, very long birthing process, shall we say. I lived in Egypt between 2011 and 2016, and I always wanted to write about women, but it took me a long time to find the right vehicle and the right characters. After we left Egypt, I went back over the next couple years and really got to know these women who I'd found and followed their stories. And then in 2019, my husband's a writer as well, and we decided to move to China. So I was living in China while still writing the Egypt book. And then because of COVID and other things, we came back to America where I finally finished the book and it came out. So one thing I always joke about is when we first moved to Egypt, my kids were in a stroller, and by the time I finished the book, they had grown up enough that they gave me the title to the book. So that's how long the whole process took. I hope it was worth it.
Do you feel comfortable with your mic there? You feel free to move it wherever you want.
I feel fine. Does it sound okay?
We're good. Great. Sweet. So I would love to just kind of start talking about the family dynamics that brought about this move to Egypt. You're married, you're living in China, Colorado, where are you before you moved to Egypt? You've got two kids, you've written this book about factory work in China, and then in 2011, right in the middle of the Arab Spring, you go to Cairo?
Yes, exactly.
So tell me about that. What brought you to move there, and what were your first impressions of the country?
Yeah, so my husband and I were both living in China. That's where we met. So we were there between, say, 1998 and 2007, and both sort of learned reporting and writing in China. Very fast-moving, fast-changing country. And then we moved back to the States in 2007, found a nice little place to rent in Ridgeway, and had a couple kids, twins. And we both always felt like we wanted to live abroad again in a different part of the world. And, you know, when you live in China and you're talking about it endlessly to people, there's this feeling like you're just the expert, you know, and you know everything. And that is always like a really dangerous thing as a writer and a journalist. You want to be in a place where you don't know everything, or people don't act like you know everything, and just sort of learn something from the ground up. So we decided that we also wanted to learn a new language. So we studied at Middlebury for exactly 8 weeks in Arabic before we moved to Egypt at the end of 2011 with twin 18-month-old babies. So yeah, it was, in retrospect, kind of a bizarre thing to do, but at the time it just seemed like the next step in living abroad in different places and writing about places that maybe other people can't get to and learn about in the depth that we're able to.
So you weren't in pursuit of the overthrow of the government. You just caused it, or you arrived upon it.
Well,
the downfall of Mubarak.
It is really funny because when we were first looking at Egypt or somewhere in the Middle East, friends of ours who lived there said, "Oh, Egypt is the perpetual underperformer. Nothing ever happens there. It's going to be really quiet. You're going to get really bored." And we're like, "This is great. We can study Arabic more and really get to know the place, and our kids can integrate." And then, of course, you know, about 6 months before we decide to go to Egypt, the Arab Spring breaks out, and so, you know, that's great too. Like, as a journalist, you love when it's quiet because then you can really get into people's lives, and you love when it's exciting because then there's so much drama. Just a note to that, when we moved to China in 2019, all our friends there were saying, "Oh, ha ha ha, you know, you've moved here, something terrible is going to happen." And 6 months later, COVID broke out.
Wow.
In Wuhan. Yeah, so, you know.
So the people of Ridgeway should watch out.
So far, Ridgeway's doing
Ridgeway
fine.
Ridgeway has done, yeah. Okay. Take your word for it. So I would love to dig into a little bit sort of how you found your subject. At the outset of your book, right in the first chapter, you describe a desire to kind of go into really rural women's lives, find storylines that are very far from kind of the known territory. You take a step back from that and sort of pivot. Why is that? And ultimately, you know, what was your subject that you found?
Yeah, so in Egypt, as in many countries in the developing world, there's just a huge gap between this very thin elite who are the people that reporters talk to the most. They speak English, they're worldly, they're articulate, they're engaged in interesting things. And then the vast majority of people who are not speaking foreign languages or having an elite education or traveling abroad or talking to foreigners. And in Egypt, it turns out that that group is maybe 1-2% of the population. And then the 98 are the people who are living basically like in a different world. You know, the people in the elite are traveling, they're going to college, their parents are supporting them, they're encouraged to work after they graduate in high-level professions. And that is not the standard for the vast majority of people. So I knew I wanted to write about ordinary people, not the elite. And in China, I had come around to writing about migrant workers in factories. And my starting point for that was just feeling that the world sort of had this very negative impression of factory workers, like they're slaves, they're terrorized, they're injured, they die in the factories. And I was thinking, well, I'm sure all those things happen, but if they happen on a massive scale, you wouldn't have millions of people leaving the village every year to go out and work, you know? So I started to talk to ordinary girls just to see what their experience of factory life was like, and it was very different from what had been portrayed in the mainstream press, including in my own newspaper, The Wall Street Journal. So in China, I wanted to write about women in the countryside in some way, in Egypt. But part of it was just logistical. Like, as a foreigner, a woman, a journalist, you feel pretty vulnerable wandering around Egyptian villages by yourself. Egypt is very heavily militarized. There are police. There are soldiers everywhere. They like to harass you. They like to ask rude questions. They don't really want you to be there. They think you don't fit in, which you don't. So I started thinking about work again and how I might maybe talk to women who are in the workplace and see, you know, what is their experience like? Because in China, what I found was that work was incredibly empowering for these young women. And in the space of a year or two, they could completely remake their lives, challenge their parents, choose who they wanted to date, move around, and just totally ignore all the expectations that the village and the family had for them. And I wondered, well, why can't this happen in Egypt as well?
Right. And that's the topic of the book, yeah.
Yeah.
So there's quite a bit there, which we'll, you know, dig into. But I would say eventually you do really kind of penetrate the domestic lives of your subjects, two of them in particular. There's a woman named Rania who works in a factory in Minya, which is a city in central Egypt. You end up becoming very familiar with her family and her home life. What was that like? Did you, in the end, feel like you were able to fulfill kind of that initial desire to kind of go into these private spaces?
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, I started off, like many things in Egypt, I sort of stumbled on this massive garment factory run by an Israeli-American investor in the middle of the desert. And that is about as weird as it sounds. I just sort of heard about it through a journalist, and we just showed up, and I looked over the main conference room area onto the floor, and there was just this massive factory with hundreds of workers on assembly lines, kind of something straight out of China, but in the middle of the Egyptian desert. And so I got the permission of the factory to just wander around. Again, this would never happen in China, where they're so nervous that you're secretly a rival and you're going to steal all their secrets and then set up a factory across the street and undercut them by 10% and kill their business. But in Egypt, they're like, yeah, go on, whatever. So I just kind of wandered around and talked to people. And one day, as I was talking to somebody else, this woman came up to me and she said, are you going to be working here because I want to be friends with you? And I said, oh, that's interesting, you know. And so a little bit later, one of the higher executives in the factory said, oh, that woman's name is Rania, and we are grooming her to become a high-level manager in the factory because she's wonderful, she's really smart, she's really productive. And then he said, but we want to do it step by step so that she doesn't get overwhelmed and that everyone says, look, this is what happens when a woman has too much ambition. And, you know, so I started to get to know Rania, and she had kind of an amazing family story. She's clearly very smart, but her father had basically, you know, the word she used was obliged her to get married at the age of 16 to a man that she didn't not love him. She didn't even like him very much, but her father liked him. And so she wasn't really able to say no. But then the marriage kind of fell apart. And so therefore she was working in this factory. But over time, you know, we spent hours and hours talking, and I watched her operate on the floor, and she was this really interesting mix of really demanding and dynamic and tough, but also very loving and sort of motherly. And, you know, the other workers who are really not much younger than her would often come up to her and say, oh, I feel bad today. And she would like pet them and give them advice and help them. I was really struck by this mix of her being like a supervisor and also like a mother, you know, and over time I saw how these two roles, how all these women had these sort of dual roles in the factory, because the family is such a huge part of their lives. And unlike in China, every night they're going back to the family and the village, and they're being the daughter and the wife and the sister and the mother again. You know, I was interested in how these two roles developed. So it was important for me to see not just what she was like in the factory, but also what she was like in the home. Those were like the two sides of her.
Right. And just because we're here on this subject now, talk a little more about, describe for listeners how the institution of the family and the relationships of the family seem to penetrate factory life. You mention all these women coming to Rania with their problems, and you describe this in the book. Both the factory and the family are a place of drama, a place of power and posturing. How do you see that play out?
Yeah, so the first full day I spent following Rania and the factory, it was the very beginning of Ramadan. And so the workers would just work all the way straight through from the time they arrived to the time they left, with a half-hour break, but their own beliefs, this was not the factory's requirements, but their own beliefs said that they should not eat or drink water from sunup to sundown. And this is like in the middle of June in Egypt. It's like 95 degrees by the time you get to the factory. So it was kind of a dramatic setup already, you know. But so I was following her around for the day. And in the course of the day, you know, let's say we were there for about an hour, and then a woman fainted on the factory floor. And I rushed over with Rania, and she was sitting there, and there was a whole bunch of women gathered around. And gradually I realized that this was kind of a drama and a performance. Like, the woman was, I think she was fine. She was kind of weepy. You know, Rania was comforting her. And then it turned out, and it took me a while to figure this out, that the woman was unhappy because she was not on Rania's line, but she had been transferred to a different line. So I was like, wow, she's using like these methods that women use in the family when they don't have power, which is like drama and performance and playing the victim, but not being the victim because she's using it to get her way. And I was like, wow, that's really interesting. I mean, I'd never seen behavior like this in a Chinese factory. Nobody is performing.
I've yet to try it myself.
Yeah.
Fainting.
Yeah,
but
try it out.
Noted. Yeah. Yes.
Yes. It seemed to work very well in the factory. Yes. Yeah. And then
I'll say, I need to ski today or else I'll faint again.
And then 2 hours later, somebody else fainted, you know, and I was like, wow, this is really bizarre. You know, this is really interesting. So that was kind of my first hint that, you know, because in China, it was sort of like you come to the factory, you come to the city, and you're transformed, you know, and it sort of gives you the ability to reinvent yourself and to become somebody else. And then you go home once a year, you're like, ta-da, here I am. You know, I'm totally different. Take it or leave it. But in Egypt, no, they don't transform. They carry what they come from to the factory. At the end of the day, they carry it back home. And that's a big reason why work is not empowering, because at the end of the day, it's still the family that's determining the value of what you do and your worth as an individual.
Mm-hmm. Right. You also thread the story of Rahim throughout the book. She runs a small factory in Cairo. In many ways, kind of as I was reading the book, I saw her as a sort of a liberated woman, a woman who insisted upon her own choices and her own liberation. How did you find Rahim? How did you encounter her and her story? And kind of when did you know that she would become such a big part of this book?
So I actually was interviewing assistants, like translators, to help me on this project. And I met a whole bunch of women who are all fantastic, because that's the nature of Egypt. The women you meet tend to be fantastic because they're working really hard against a lot of obstacles. But this one woman, Amira, she said, oh, I actually used to work in the garment industry, and I know this woman who runs a small factory, and she's a friend of mine, and I know some other women as well. And I was like, okay, you're hired. You know, take me to these places. So one of the women she introduced me to was this woman named Raham, who runs a small garment factory outside Alexandria, like probably like when I visited her, maybe 15 workers. So very small, very modest operation. But I went, and I mean, one of the things in journalism is when you first meet someone, you know pretty quickly if it's going to work. And usually it's whether they're just like, I have so much to tell you. And then they talk endlessly for like several hours, which is what happened with Raham. Like, let me tell you all the ways in which this is not working and this is hard. And so it was interesting because she was not only trying to run a factory, she was trying in a small way to revolutionize her little piece of society. And so she had all these young women working for her, and she was like, I want to teach them, you know, to stand up to their parents and not just to get married really early and to make sure that the person they marry has a good job and insurance and treats them well, you know, and to eat well. You know, she had this whole list of things that she wanted to teach these young girls who were, you know, 16 or 17, you know. And I found this mix of her business acumen and her idealism to be really fascinating, and I wanted to see how that developed.
Right. And at the Delta Factory in Minya, there are other ways in which, you know, these factory managers are trying to sort of revolutionize their workers, and that, you know, has societal implications, even if it's a different kind of motivation than Raham has, which is sort of aimed at sort of the uplift of these women's lives in Egypt. You know, for them in this larger factory in Minya and Delta, it's much more about productivity and kind of impressing a system on a place which has no system.
Yeah, I think in both places it's kind of a mix. I think definitely these are business people and they have to run a factory and make enough money to keep going. But I think in both cases they saw the two projects as related. This idea of teaching women to feel more accountable, more disciplined, more empowered is intimately connected with teaching women to be good workers and to want to be promoted and to work hard. So yeah, it was really interesting in the Delta factory that when I finally met the CEO, who's a British man who had worked in the garment industry himself, he actually came from Birmingham and he sort of rose up from the factory floor. I was really shocked when he said, "Oh, we really want to promote a woman as manager as a way to sort of show all the other people what women are possible of. And we hope in this way," like he was trying in this small way to change society on his turf, you know, and I thought that was really interesting. And you know, when you spend time in the factory, you realize it really is like a little community. Like it's like a workplace, but it's very enclosed. There's usually not many windows. You just feel very much that you're here with these other people. You're working really intimately all day long. You're under pressure to produce at a really high level. So yeah, it was like its own little community. And in each case, I could see people trying to improve the community in ways that were not just about productivity and economics, but also about social change and empowerment.
Did you like spending all that time on the factory floor?
I did. Yeah. People always ask me like, "What? Why do you like to go to factories?" Like, it seems so awful. Yeah. I mean, it's not as nice.
It's time to learn to sew.
Yeah, I'm really fascinated by factories because, you know, you go in and it's sort of like the secret world, you know, you don't know anything about it, and then you start learning, you talk to people, and the factory has its hierarchy, it has its crimes, it has its secrets, it has people who are having affairs, people who hate each other, people who are plotting this and that and everything, and it's just fascinating to learn about that. So, and as a reporter, it's also a good venue because a factory is tied, no matter how small, it's tied to the global economy, because if there's a price change or there's a climate thing somewhere or there's a new product, or, you know, they have to respond, you know. And so in that sense, they're both like a very tight, intimate community, and they're also connected to the globe and the global marketplace. And I find that combination really interesting and also promising as a reporter, because...
And the American consumer. Yeah. I mean, these brands that they're producing are...
No, it's directly tied
Walmart,
to us.
Walmart, Tommy John, all that stuff.
Yeah, this factory that I report, I mean, both factories I reported in were exporting to the U.S. And in one case, one day I went to the Delta factory when they were in the middle of this huge production and there were crates and hangers everywhere. And I picked up a pair of shorts and it said Walmart $7.98. You know, it was like, it was ready for Walmart. Like there it was, you know, in the middle of rural Egypt, you know. And then later I went home and I looked online and that exact pair of shorts was for sale at Walmart for $7.98. Like, it was like, wow. But then at the same time, you have this incredible connection through the whole globe, and yet these women are completely cut off from the global change that globalization is supposed to bring, you know? So mm-hmm. I found that tension really, really shocking and really surprising, yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm really interested in... kind of moving towards some of discussing the forces which keep these women locked in place. I do want to say that for those listening on the radio at home, you're tuned into Off the Record, broadcasting live from the Telluride Arts HQ on Main Street. We're joined by journalist Leslie Chang this evening, who's discussing her new book, which is based on years of research and lived experience in Egypt. For those who are in the audience this evening, or if you're at home with a pressing question and want to run down to the gallery here to ask it, it is a public affairs program, so I welcome you to jostle in your seats or raise your hand or do whatever. Don't be shy. Jump in with a question throughout the remainder of the program. Yeah, just give us a little signal, and this mic is hot, so they can hear you on air. All right, I think it's perhaps it's a moment to discuss maybe marriage. In your account, it becomes so central to sort of the repression of women, and yet everybody marries, even women such as Raham, who swear they have no wish to marry and will never take a husband. Many of them end up in a marriage. What was it like to watch this happen during your years there?
Yeah, there's just one of the things that really surprised me is the incredible pressure on women, on young women to marry well and to marry very young. It's this idea of child marriage is no longer that prevalent, marrying at 13 or 14, but from the time a young woman is, you know, even before she's entered puberty, her parents are usually planning who is she going to marry and how are we going to gather all the things for her trousseau. So the family is often just stocking like dishes and silverware and blankets for this girl when she's like 10 years old, you know. And that seemed to be such a physical manifestation of the pressure for these women, for these girls. You know, you're going to school and you have these dreams, and then in the attic or in the next room, there's all this silverware and dishes and blankets that are waiting for you to be used after you get married. Like, what kind of message is that giving young girls? So, you know, the average age of marriage in Egypt for women is 20, and for in rural Egypt, it's 19. So it's still quite young. And when you think about that, that really precludes a lot of things, you know. Like most of the girls and women I met had, you know, gone to middle school. Some of them had even gone to kind of a vocational high school. But then once they were done with that, it was time for marriage, you know. And of course they would, you know, I'd meet these young women and I'd meet their parents and they'd say, well, of course, after she marries, if she wants to, she can pursue her dream. And I said, well, what's her dream? Oh, she wants to be a doctor. She wants to be an artist. It's like, I don't really see their husbands wanting them to go out and be an artist or go out and spend, you know, 5 years going to medical school while they've just gotten married and their expectation is to have children very quickly. So yeah, just sheer timing and pressure just made it really impossible for women to develop any kind of careers. And what was really interesting was that the women in the Delta factory, a lot of them, as you said, they'd married and come out the other side, and probably like a quarter of the workers were divorced. And it was fascinating that because they were divorced, it kind of liberated them to no longer buy the idea like my whole life has to revolve around a man, because it turns out that did not work out so well, you know. And so now, having lost that dream, they would be working in the factory. But it wasn't an empowerment. It wasn't like, I've been liberated, I'm so happy to be working here. It was like that marriage was traumatic. And I'm just barely surviving, and I'm working. Often they had custody of their kids because the husband wasn't supporting them. So they were working basically for survival, not for any sort of career or empowerment or choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this issue of divorce also becomes huge. And as you say, you kind of come to see divorce as like a marker of women's liberation. You meet a divorced woman named Doa, who is in school, and of her you write, I learned from her what it meant to break free. And yet there are all these systems that persist. She has a very difficult relationship with her children. Mm-hmm. What's that like?
Yeah, so she had, Doa was a security guard in the factory in Minya where I was reporting. And I remember the first time I met her, she was wearing this like bright blue long dress, and she said, "Hello, I am Doa. Do you have a new husband for me?" As you know, and I said, "Well, do you want a husband from Egypt or China or America?" And she said, "Definitely not from Egypt." You know, and I was like, "Ooh, this is a lively woman. I like this one." So it turned out that she had been studying law in college, which is quite unusual. She came from kind of an ordinary family. And then she married someone who was a cousin on her mother's side, and it was kind of this typical thing where while he was wooing her and trying to convince the family to let him marry her, he said, "Oh, she can continue her education." And as soon as they got married, he's like, "Nope, you're done." You know, so she had to drop out, and she had a couple kids, and then they had a really, really bad, unhappy marriage. And finally, she divorced him through actually a new system that allows women to divorce their husbands. For more than 100 years, Egyptian women have not had the right to divorce their husbands unless they go through court and go through this incredibly lengthy, expensive process to show that the husband has wronged them in very specific ways. So anyway, that is a systemic change that allowed her to divorce her husband. But as we were talking, she said, "Yeah, I have 2 kids, they're 6 and 7. And I said, "So where are your kids?" And she said, "Oh, I gave custody to my husband." And I said, "Oh my God, why?" And she said, "I knew if I divorced him and I took the kids, he would never pay a cent for their support. And I can't afford to take care of them on my own." Of course, the court system are not implementing the proper things, because by law, she deserves, you know, alimony from her husband. So she just gave the kids to her husband. So that was kind of the price she paid. In order to divorce this horrible person, she had to give up her children. And then I said, "So how many times have you seen your kids?" And she said, "I haven't seen them, you know?" And then over the course of 2 years, I watched her, and she, at one point, she did get her husband agreed, because her family pressured him, to let her see her kids. And they came for one day. And initially they were fighting and they were angry and they were said, "Our father says you hate him." And clearly they'd been hearing all this horrible stuff. But in the course of the day, she convinced them and said, "You know, I'm working hard. We're going to study together. We're going to rise," you know, and she like totally inspired them. And then so next week they were going to come by again. And then again they came and they were screaming and fighting with her. And after a few more times, she decided, "I can't do this anymore. This is too painful." And so she hasn't seen her kids since then, you know. So yeah, so it was, you know, it is a type of freedom, but it's a freedom that comes at a really high price.
And do you think women see divorce as a form of freedom? Do they recognize that? Because, you know, many people remarry.
Yeah, I don't think, because the culture emphasizes marriage so strongly, I don't think they see divorce as liberation. They see divorce as failure. And they would really like, you know, Doa was unusual. She said, "I've lived with a man, I've lived without a man. Let me tell you, living without a man is much better." But she was quite unusual, and it was hard to say where her story would go. But most women, even if they didn't say it, I think they would want to remarry just for the security and the financial support. I mean, it's natural. You're raising kids on your own is not hard, is not easy financially, but it's also, there's a lot of social pressure. You're very much an outlier. And you're seen as a failure.
Yeah.
Leslie, I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you gained access to the factories and what that entailed and the difficulties and challenges that came with that.
Yeah, it was actually surprisingly easy in Egypt. Once I found the factory, for example, I mentioned stumbling on this Delta factory in the middle of the desert. And then I talked to these to the executives there, and I explained who I was. I actually gave them a copy of my previous book on China, and I said, "This is the kind of reporting I do. It's really personal, it's social, I'm not looking to do an expose, although there might be some bad things in the factory that I'll report, but there'll also be, you know, positive and neutral things." And they thought about it for a while, and they just said yes, you know, which was, I guess, a little surprising, you know. And then the other factory, Raham's, she's just on her own, and it's a small factory. So once I got the introduction through the friend who was my translator, she was very open as well. I mean, that's one thing that you learn as you report in different places, is the cultures are just really, really different. And in Egypt, people, they're just really outgoing. They love to talk. They love joking. It's just the best place to be a reporter because, you know, everyone. And I noticed this in the Delta factory, like as I was walking around interviewing people, like I described Rania coming up to me, but women would do that sometimes. You know, they would just come up to me and said, I have a story I want you to hear, you know, and that would never happen in China. And then the opposite, when you finally found someone and you'd say, I want to hear your story, they'd say, oh, I'm not interesting. Go talk to somebody else, you know. It's like, well, I think you're really interesting, you know. So it's just a really different culture, and that really affects how things feel as a reporter.
Telluride is much more like Egypt, I think.
Yeah, no, Americans are much more like Egyptians, just very garrulous. They want to tell you their stories. They're just relaxed, you know. And people in China tend to be more reserved. They're more shy. They're more formal. You know, when you finally do talk to them, they've got amazing stories, and they can be very funny and very lively. And, you know, the person who you think is sitting there really quietly, like they're picking up every little thing that's happening. And when you finally talk to them, they tell you everything. And it's such a great experience. But, yeah, it is harder to crack that nut initially. And as I mentioned, it was really hard to get access inside any kind of bigger factory because they were so nervous about commercial espionage, basically.
Sorry, I just have one more question. What did anything happen that didn't make it into the book, like that you were not allowed to report on?
So now we want the...
Yeah, the real dirt, yeah. Well, let me say, you know, what I always think about my China reporting, to start, is that I could have written a second book with all the material that I didn't put in the first book because there was just so much stuff that I uncovered and I spent so much time there. I'm fluent in Chinese, so I could just spend 10 hours sitting somewhere and listening to people talk and getting so much stuff. There were some personal details of the two women who I focused on that I ended up not putting in the book just to protect them. Of course, they knew I was writing the whole time I was taking notes, but of course, you know, because I know them personally, I know a lot of things about them that I think, you know, the world doesn't need to know, you know. With Egypt, I don't think there was anything in there I felt like I shouldn't put in. For whatever reason, it was just more straightforward. I did have less material just because I'm not fluent in Arabic. I speak some, but I was working through translators. So I felt like I was fortunate in the 2 years that I was reporting to get these really dramatic life trajectories. But there wasn't like a ton of material that I felt like I had to leave out for whatever reason.
On the note of kind of these translators, they're sort of peripheral characters. You know, we know them by name, but not a whole lot about them. What was it like working through translators, and how did you meet these people? Did they cut a different profile? You know, some of them are women, working women, than, you know, the other women you were reporting on.
Yeah, they were all... So I told you about the first woman I met, Amira, and she... After I worked with her for about a year, she went to Italy to study costume design, but she introduced me to her friend, Sarah. And Sarah was also great and really smart.
You didn't follow her to Italy? That sounds like a good story
to
tell.
Now that's a good idea.
Costume
yeah.
design.
Are you going to work in the garment industry?
Yes. I'm already reporting on the garment industry.
Like a huge detour from my Egypt plan, yes. And then she introduced me to Sarah, who was great. And then after a few months, she went to England to study heritage protection, and she passed me on to somebody else. So there was just this cohort of really talented, gifted, smart women. I mean, elite, as I described.
Yes, the 2%.
The 2%. Yeah, very well educated. And they were indispensable for me. But it was interesting because when I would speak with the young women in the factory through these translators, often afterwards the translators would say, oh my God, I can't believe that story. Or, you know, there was a huge gap between me and the
right.
girls, but there was also a huge gap between them and the girls, you know, and they were learning a lot about how poor people lived basically in their own country.
Yeah. And for them, did the same compulsion to marry exist in the same way?
Interesting, yeah. So they had a lot more leverage, I think. Mostly their parents were educated and believed in their education and for them to work. And so, yeah, I mean, the women I was working with were all in their 20s, late 20s, early 30s, which is definitely very late to not be married by Egyptian standards. And they were clearly holding out until either to not marry or probably to really wait for somebody who they felt would support them in their education and their career. So yeah, they were definitely outliers in that sense as well. But one of the women, Amira, she told me that, so that all the workers in the factory would talk about how their families were preparing their trousseau for them. It was called the Gehaz. And then, so I spent a whole day talking to all these factory women, like, what's in your Gehaz? Oh, how many teacups? How many sheets? And later I heard they talked to the factory owner. They were like, this woman's really weird. She keeps asking us all these questions. I was like, I'm really fascinated because there were like such specific rules. You have to have like, you know, 10 sets of towels and 20 sets of sheets. And then that day as we were leaving the factory, Amira said to me, you know, my mom is already... bought the Gehaz for me and my sister when we were in our early teens. And I said, well, what's that feel like? And she said, I was so young, I didn't realize it was intended for me. And then she said, for years now, I've been telling my mom, just use the stuff. Don't just let it sit there, you know? And she said, my mom started using it, which I think is a good sign. So she was kind of holding her own against her family.
Hi, thanks for coming. I loved Factory Girls.
Thank you.
I have a question actually about Egypt versus China in the sense that manufacturing is huge in China. It's the world's manufacturing floor, and so therefore it's had a huge impact on the economy and especially society and the women working in those factories. Can you give a sense for how much of an impact this sector has had in Egypt? Because I don't see so many tags that say made in Egypt. Is it having effects on sort of individual women or society as a whole, this movement? And yeah. Maybe the answer is by the book.
Well, I'll say that, but I'll also answer your question. So one of the things that I was interested in about Egypt other than women was the cotton and textile industry. Because if you ask, what do you know about an Egyptian brand? It's Egyptian cotton, right? So I was curious, like what... And then I started reading, and it turned out Egyptian cotton is still like the finest grade cotton in the world. It just grows there naturally, and it's still exported into the finest garments and underwear and stockings and sheets in fine hotels, as we know. But what happened to that industry? Why is it that that industry has not translated into gains for the country? And so what I found was that Egyptian leaders over like more than 100 years have been trying to build a garment industry based on high quality cotton, and time and again they failed since like the early 1800s for various reasons that I do explore in the book, like corruption and, you know, socialism and not figuring out how the market works. And so this has a direct impact on women, because when we look at women working in globalized economies all over the world, a huge industry is manufacturing, specifically garments. So, you know, there are women in China who are working in factories, women in Bangladesh, women in Morocco, women in Malaysia and Indonesia, and all these places you see that female empowerment follows after women start working in large numbers. But in Egypt, that industry, manufacturing in general, just has never taken root because of very poor government leadership and bad policies. So I found this figure that said Egypt manufacturing makes up only 15% of economic output, and that figure has stayed the same for like 70 years. So that's just a number on a piece of paper, but when you look at women's lives, that makes a huge impact on whether they have opportunities or not.
Yeah. We had sort of been scoping out a little spot for a reading. Do you think that now might be appropriate for that?
Yeah, sure.
All right. You know, just as to tee it up a little bit, you know, as I was reading the book, from having all these experiences, seeing the way these women are brought to work and then forced to leave work through marriage or through restrictive family structures or through Raham and her factory has so many challenges with kind of changing government and economic catastrophes, basically, that, you know, are always kind of coming up. So basically, in many ways, you come down pretty hard on kind of the Egyptian society and its ability to empower these women and embrace economic and cultural change. So I would invite you to kind of read this section with sort of China as a bit of a backdrop, but also and then just invite you to kind of reflect on that observation I have about what you find in Egypt. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is in a part towards the end of the book where I look at all the factors that made China develop in one way and Egypt develop in a very different one. In China, people can imagine a better life. The national obsession to ru shi, join the world, is born of a system that rewards self-improvement and builds expectations of a brighter future. Individuals want to change because they know it will bring opportunity. They're just not sure yet what form it will take. The Egyptian system fosters instead a breakdown of the imagination. In an unpromising socioeconomic environment, people tend to focus on the costs of change rather than the benefits. To engage with the outside world, especially as a young woman, may bring risk, criticism, or even danger. So individuals talk themselves out of taking chances. There's little faith that landing a poorly paid job may lead to a better one, or that taking a class may impart the skills or confidence to change one's direction in life. In an uncertain world, it may be rational for a woman to stick to society's rules, to rely on a man for sustenance, to lock herself into marriage early. But where does that leave you? In China, I knew a young woman who talked her way into half a dozen jobs that she wasn't qualified for, and another who changed her identity from assembly line worker into manager of 20 such workers in a year. And yet another who went straight from being a penniless student of English to a highly paid teacher of the language. None of these developments was rational either. The transformation of China over the past several decades was possible because of economic policy, geography, and history. But it also needed millions of individuals who broke the rules that school and their parents had taught them. They could envision a different way to be, and the imagination is where change begins.
So I
looked at all these factors like geography and economy and religion, family, that caused young women to not want to break the rules and take chances. But I also saw that there was this mental, attitude that was so prevalent in China that was completely missing in Egypt. And that was the sense that I'm going to change. I'm going to make myself better. And then something good will come of it. And of course, on an individual level, you can't blame a person for not having those ideas if nobody around them has them. But it's also kind of a chicken and egg thing. Like, you know, if people were to start have these ideas, things could change, you know. And so that, you know, the reason why the book is titled Egyptian Made is, in that sense, Egyptians are sort of creating that reality for themselves. You want to draw a fine line. You don't want to blame them, but you also want to say, look, you know, there are things that could change, but it also has to start with you as well as with all these other policy issues that are so problematic.
I have a question. I'm Sarah. My daughter went to Morocco for an exchange program and lived with a very traditional family, you know, who ate with their hands, didn't have toilet paper in the bathroom, slept on banquettes in their living room. But they had super cool, very advanced children who lived outside the home, worked as translators, and the families were able, I think, to live in both worlds. And it sounds like, from what I've heard from your book, you're talking about individual women who have made choices, but I wonder, are the families able to kind of live with those two worlds, like very traditional and still hoping for more for their children? And I think you spoke a little bit about it when you just read, but I wonder if you could address like the families' either support or kind of horror of the modern world.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I mean, I did not see that at all. And I think that you put your finger on the problem, which is people who are traditional, but who can accept that change is coming and that it brings opportunity for their kids, especially their daughters. Among sort of the ordinary people in rural Egypt who I met, there was not that keeping both those ideas in their head at the same time, not at all. Yeah, Morocco is an interesting example because I don't know the family that you were living with, but they have had kind of a burst of female employment starting in the 90s because they did start doing manufacturing garments in large numbers. So that is actually kind of a counterpoint to Egypt. Like, they succeeded in many ways in bringing women into the workforce, and maybe that's kind of what you were seeing, places where people, women were working in some numbers so that people had started to accept it and maybe even encourage it. And I mean, that's one of the really fascinating things is, you know, I hope people don't read a book like this and think things will never change, like this is so hopeless, because things can change. And, you know, I write in the book how in China in the 90s when I used to visit, you know, it was a complete economic basket case and the service was terrible and everyone talked about how the work ethic is terrible. And I remember going to restaurants and waiters would say, you know, we don't have many dishes here and they're all bad, you know, like, please leave. And that was the 90s, you know? And nowadays we're like, oh yeah, the Chinese are the hardest people working in the world, but they weren't always. Like, you had to have the systems in place and the leadership, the incentive, so that people are like, hey, if I work hard, I'm going to get something for myself, you know? So I think with Egypt, with the right leadership and the right policies, you can turn things around in 20 years, you know? But I don't see that happening with military leaders. They are not the people who care about education and manufacturing and gender equality. They're not focused on those changes and improvements. But if you had the right person, you know, things can change.
For those listening from home, you are tuned into Off the Record, broadcasting live from the Telluride Arts Galleries. And we are joined this evening by journalist Leslie Chang, who is discussing her new book, Egyptian Made, based on years of research and lived experience in Egypt. Well, we don't have a whole lot of time left, but there's a lot more that I'm interested in. I guess, you know, one thing I was thinking about is that kind of right now, Egypt is primarily in the news in the context of the war in Gaza and the humanitarian crisis that is happening along its border. In the book, you sort of encounter this country that is sort of, you know, has some very global perspectives and global ties, but also has all these deeply traditional ties to kind of the way things have been, the family, Sharia law. How do you think, you know, this country is responding to the moment in the Middle East right now? Are you in touch with people there, and how are they responding? I mean, this factory is one of the factories is an Israeli kind of Egyptian initiative to try to heal this divide.
I actually just heard from the CEO of that factory, and he said they're doing great. I mean, they're expanding. They already have two factories, and they're building a third. So in that sense, you know, on that very micro level, things are going very well. But certainly in Egypt, there is a huge, not just a crisis, but also an economic crisis, because Egypt, as you mentioned, is right in the middle of all that. And so, for example, one of their economic pillars is actually importing natural gas from Israel and exporting it onto Europe. That's one of their big sources of foreign exchange. And that, of course, has totally, you know, died right now. The economic situation in Egypt is sort of very bad and getting worse. The Egyptian pound is worth about 1/8 of what it was when I was there. So that means inflation is crazy and people's salaries buy less and less all the time. But it is interesting because Egypt is sort of at the crossroads, and that is the, unlike China, which is able to sort of be isolated for so long, Egypt has always been in the middle of everything. Everyone has colonized it, you know, the Greeks and then the Romans and then, you know, the, you know, Muslims from the Middle East and then, you know, the British and the French, like everyone has ruled this country. You know, everyone has been there and tried to take its wealth and use it for themselves. And so in that sense, Egypt is quite a cosmopolitan place. And I noticed when we first got there that it's much more welcoming than China, for example. You know, even though it's very poor and people might not have seen that many, you know, they're used to seeing foreigners and they're very welcoming. If you stood on a street corner, people will just mob you and be like, can I help you? Where do you need to go? And then they would take you there themselves, you know? So yeah, in that sense, very cosmopolitan. So that makes that sort of very repressive expectations of women all the more surprising, because you feel like this is naturally like really outgoing people in a really cosmopolitan country, but because of the ways Islam has been interpreted and implemented, it's been used to sort of keep women down. And that's sort of an incredible tragedy of the place.
How much are you in touch with kind of the people who you wrote about?
I have been trying to get back in touch with them because it's been a while since I talked to them. So Raham, the woman who owns the small garment factory, she's still working. She's still doing, well, you do have to read the book because some things happened to her and her business, but she is persisting. She's still surviving. And Rania, last time I talked to her, so she had, for various reasons, left the Delta factory, and she had been trying to find some other places to work, but nothing had really worked out for her. And that's one of the ways in which I compare Egypt and China, was the workers I knew in China, they jumped factories half a dozen times, they quit all the time, but then there were always like dozens of other factories to go choose from. And Rania, when her relations with the factory for various reasons soured, she really didn't have any other options. So she was looking at this and that, but nothing quite worked out for her. So last I heard, she's still living at home and looking for something.
I just want to circle back to your twins.
Yes, I was just about to say, we've talked all about this book, but not all about you. So the last 3 minutes, my goodness.
Yeah.
Let's hear about it.
Did you say they were 18 months when you were... Okay, so I'm just curious what mantra or parenting sort of takeaway that you have from your experiences that you have... you know, implemented into your own life and into your own parenting.
Yep.
Do you have their gazas yet?
Yes, it's never too early. No,
I mean, it's coming right up. Yeah. 20 is close.
Yeah, so my husband and I always wanted, you know, we've lived abroad in various places, and we always wanted our kids to feel very comfortable with that. And maybe going to Egypt in the middle of a revolution while they were babies was a little extreme. But yeah, we wanted them to feel like they're comfortable with people who are different and that they're comfortable being different, you know. So that experience was amazingly great for them. You know, Pete and I would go off and report all these terribly horrible, violent things. He'd get shot at in a protest and then come home, and then the babies would just be like playing. And, you know, we lived on this island called Zamalek, which is in the middle of the Nile, but was somewhat insulated from the protests in Tahrir, which was actually only like a mile away. But that was one of the very strange things about these political conflicts, is that you could have mayhem and bloodshed and violence, and then a mile away, people are doing their grocery shopping and picking up their dry cleaning, because that's how life is, right? So I think they had, I remember one time we went to, the kids were maybe three, and we went away for, I think back to the States for like a month, and then came back to Egypt, and we were in the airport, and there was this woman walking the airport, and she was in full niqab, which you've seen with the everything is covered except these tiny little spots for her eyes. And it's like a very shocking visually for someone who hasn't ever seen it. And then the girls saw her and they just like waved at her, you know, because for them that was just normal. Like, here's this woman who's like, yeah, I've seen this, you know. So Pete and I were like, oh yeah, we've done good, you know. And since we came back from Egypt, we've stayed here a few years, and then went and lived in China for 2 years, and we put them in a Chinese public school. And force them to learn Chinese in that way. So I just wanted them, we just wanted them to feel, you know, you want to be comfortable, you want to have friends, but you also want to be comfortable being different, and that doesn't stand in the way of you having friends or being yourself. And that has actually been a lesson in Ridgeway, because, you know, we originally wanted to live there for 5 years in China, but we came back after two, and so they've had the whole glory of the American middle school experience, and Mean Girls and all sorts of things. And so again, we're trying to tell them, you know, you be yourself, you have friends, but you know, don't worry if you're not like the other kids or how they want you to be, and you know, you're strong being yourself. So
it's,
we're trying.
It's revolution in Egypt, pandemic in China, middle school in the U.S.
All these catastrophes, one after another. Yes.
Middle school in Ridgeway.
Yeah.
Are you going to stick around for a little bit? What's your next project? What are you mulling next?
I think I'd like to do something in America about workers. Yeah. I'll look into it. I'll let you know.
Okay. take a minute to rest, because this was an astonishing effort, an engaging read. You make such fabulous company as the narrator of this extremely educating tale. So thank you so much for sharing this work with us and for your work.
Thank you. It's great to have you to be here, and great to talk to you. Thanks.
All right. This has been a live audience off the record, I should say. It's always live. Who knows if we're still on radio? I think we are, but we're past our 7 o'clock deadline, so we got to give it over to the DJ. A huge thank you to Telluride Arts for co-sponsoring this event, for hosting us here. Thanks to everybody who came out, and thanks to everybody at home who listened. Thank you, Leslie, and Coto News will be back next week with another Off the Record. So till then, keep your dial tuned to 91.7.